Hi, and welcome to this episode of the VFX Show. Alien Romulus is about to come out. It's actually the seventh installment of the Alien franchise. But we thought that rather than talk about that, we should go back to 1979 and talk about Alien, or at least Matt Wallen was very keen to do that. Mike Seymour, being myself, put his hand up for Aliens, the 1986 film. So Jason Diamond mediated and said, why don't we discuss both? So that's what we're going to do today. Welcome to the show, everybody, and welcome to you, Matt.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you, Jason.
Very pleased to be coming out of hypersleep.
Okay, now to start this whole thing off, and obviously we're going to get geeking out, like nerding out to the nth degree in a second, but I want to just raise this as a flag. The reason that I was so keen on Aliens, plural, is because I think it's brilliant, but also I think it's one of the all-time great sequels. So let's start out the show by seeing if you guys agree with me. So just quickly, top three sequels where the sequel was at least as good, if not better than the original. So I'm going to lead off with the first one, which I think Aliens is actually better than Alien. Now, before you start screaming at me, Matt, I'll give you a chance to talk about it in a second, but that's my vote, right? But Matt, do you have like an example of a really great sequel that's better than the original?
So this one's kind of weird, but if you think about it, Raiders of the Lost Ark is a sequel to Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And Raiders of the Lost Ark
not
is
really.
It is, though, in the in
that's this timeline. That's the difference between a prequel and a sequel.
I mean, right? I guess I would say, I think, you know, when I think of movies with sequels, I suppose the first one that comes to mind for me is just Empire, I think is such a great sequel to the original Star Wars. You couldn't have Empire without Star Wars, but there's so much rich character building. It's such a good script and, you know, all the effects are kind of at their apex.
Jason?
I mean, I was going to say Empire as well, but I kind of like the concept of the turn it on its ear and prequel sequelize it and say Raiders, because I mean, you know, I'm buying into it.
Because for me,
Terminator 2 might be better than the original
Terminator 2. That's what I was going to say. I was like, Terminator 2, Godfather Part 2, and Aliens are my top three. Without
a little brain freeze for sure.
Because Godfather Part 2 is just, you know, like it's the ultimate dad film, right? It's like, it's like, and there's just no two ways about it. Like Terminator 2 was spectacular. Now, what does Terminator 2 have in common with Aliens? Let me think for a second. Oh, wait, it's Jim Cameron. So I'm not casting shade over Alien. I'm just saying Aliens, Get Away From Her, You Bitch, is just the film for me. And I have watched that in pure daylight, on my laptop, in the kitchen, in the middle of the day, and my daughter has walked in to say, hi, Dad, and I've leapt about 3 feet in the air, right? Like,
a quick story about Aliens is in 1986, when that movie came out, I was 16. Yep. I was a junior in high school. I was driving, and my best friend at the time in high school was my friend Andy Dabney, and we went at night to see Aliens. And it was just me and him hanging out, goofing off one night. And we saw the movie and we both totally loved it, which, by the way, my favorite line is, I say we take off and nuke the entire site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
Well, it's also, but hang on, wait, let's not get past the, wait a second, they're in the room.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Well, I prefer game over.
Game over as you're going down. Yeah. But the thing I remember most about that night seeing that movie was one, I mean, I really enjoyed that movie. It was so fun at that age. It was perfect. But we were driving home on the 55 freeway in Southern California, like, and driving back. As we were driving down the street, there were no cars on the street. We went to a late show. You know, it's totally quiet. Sure. And my friend was driving and he had a moonroof in his car. And it was open and we were super freaked out. We had to close it because we were all convinced we were going to be attacked. It was pretty great.
Yes. Sigourney being, of course, VFX royalty. I mean, if we had to have a queen or that we would pay homage to in this show, I would vote for Sigourney, right? Apart from the fact that she is a marvelous actress and I would like happily drink her bathwater. Like the her resume of films, like obviously we know her from Aliens, but Avatar, of course, another huge one. But then there are so many
Ghostbusters.
But like it's just the tip of the iceberg, right? Like the more that you get into her back catalog, the more that you just are stunned.
Cabin in the Woods. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. That you haven't hit my highlight yet. Keep going.
I'm trying to think.
Dig deep into Sigourney Weaver pantheon.
Thoughts on Sigourney. obviously Ghostbusters, right? You could even have gone there with Finding Dory, or I think she was in but no, that isn't the one I'm heading for. Think VFX show and homage to all things geeky. I'm not talking about her appearance in WALL-E.
Oh, Galaxy Quest.
Thank you very much. Oh, Galaxy Quest.
Took me a second.
Yeah. But that's just so many of them, right? And that's so many other great films that she's done, even apart from that, like the comedies that she's done, okay, they've dated some of them, right? Like I'm sure that if I was ever to go back and watch Working Girl, I'd be cringing a bit. But Dave was hysterically funny, and there's just a whole bunch of films that she's on. So anyway, Aliens.
And fitting because Alien was her first film.
Was it? I think it was her second film. I think you'll find.
She might have had a bit part, but it's certainly her first leading role.
She was in Annie Hall. Yeah.
Right, and let's face brief, it, though.
Oh, come on. First film with, are we allowed to still like Annie Hall? I mean, I don't know. How much are we?
It's a great Woody movie.
Been, I think you could still like it.
Okay, good. Because I like Woody Allen, and I thought that was too young to see it when it first came out, but to talk about a moment in cinema history, like Annie Hall. Mm-hmm. That's your first film. You're not going too badly. Apart from that, Gordon Willis was the DOP, right? The cinematographer. I mean, wow. Anyway, so Sigourney royalty, but yes, as you say, Aliens was the film that like really made us just all worship at the altar of Sigourney. And for so many years, we've been going to see her in every kind of sci-fi thing. And yet she hasn't got, I don't know, jaded or like, I don't know, she's survived the press and everything that's been part of these big films without appearing dated in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. And clearly she gets on well with James Cameron.
Yeah.
As Avatar 3, 4, and 5 will
maybe
no doubt
she's
continue
a,
to show.
Maybe she's a background actor in Titanic somewhere.
maybe so, yeah.
Well, she's always stayed a really iconic, strong female lead character in virtually everything she's in. And she's kind of, I always say she's kind of like the Billie Jean King of acting. You know, she's like really pushing forward in these performances where she's a strong figure and overshadows so many times her male counterparts, I think too, in a way that is appropriate to the role and to the parts and stuff, but she's a really powerful
also,
screen with, presence, I think.
With probably the exception of the last scene in Alien, she's not been playing a sexy kind of, femme fatale or whatever. I think the last scene in Alien is a notable exception to that. But leaving that aside for a second, they're not typically sexualized roles. They're hardcore acting roles.
Well, yes, but they're not masculine roles. They're still feminine roles.
100%,
I know what you mean. I know what you're saying. Like she hasn't been, she hasn't either chosen or been needed to have an overly sexualized role. I would obviously she's a romantic female lead in Ghostbusters and is plenty sexy in the movie, but it's not, there's nothing gratuitous ever about the films
exactly,
she's in, I believe is maybe the term, but
she's neither, as you say, taking on a masculine role, nor is she in any way walking away from her femininity in any of these roles. She just seems to walk a brilliant line.
And in Aliens, even though there's not really room for a romantic, interlude a la Terminator 1 with Linda Hamilton and Michael Biehn and Sigourney Weaver, do have a insinuated chemistry that they are sort of connected. Like throughout their adventure, it is certainly insinuated that they are a bit of a team. There's not really any sexual tension, but because it's a man and a woman, I believe it's intimated just enough that they are, you know, they've been drawn to each other.
So
that's what I get out of it.
100%. So in a second, we're going to spin just to Alien. But before we do, let me just set the stage for those that are not keeping score. So as I said, there are a whole lot of Alien films. Let me give them in chronological order, having you guys busted me over this prequel sequel thing. Okay. So in the timeline of the canon, and by the way, this is not a well realized path. There are lots of inconsistencies and rewriting of history, etc. But anyway, it was Alien versus Predator. Then it was Alien versus Predator Requiem, Prometheus, Alien Covenant, then Alien, then Aliens, Alien 3, and Alien Resurrection, and of course the new one that's yet to land. So those are the films that we have to in the kind of space. Of course, there are video games and a ton of other stuff. And to my personal opinion, if I was to rate those, and I'm really keen on your opinion, but I would say Aliens 1, Alien 2, Prometheus 3. That would just be me. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that's close. I'd probably say Alien first, and then I think Aliens. And then I suppose the Prometheus and Covenant movies are in there somewhere. I'm excited to see the new thing this summer when it, or end of the summer when this comes out.
You're not worried that it's just going to be a horror film? Weeks.
I don't mind if it's just a horror film. I think Alien is just a horror film in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I think it's so much more. I just, you know, I'm not a fan of horror, but oh my God. I mean, they're horrifying, but I just don't think of them as just, they are.
Well, it's a really good horror film that has, that has like a lot of other overtones and kind of thematic elements to it.
But both of them, Alien and Aliens, are, I will use the term, replete with jump scares. Which are, you know, well, I mean, there's always the aliens kind of coming out and whatever.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, but they transcend a genre.
Yes, 100%.
Like you could
argue.
But
it's sci-fi horror. I mean, the tagline, in space, no one can hear you scream. That is a horror tagline. That is not
that is true.
And I think I think they also kind of live in the space of sort of the 70s political conspiracy theory thriller too, in that there's the corporation and the sort of corporation sinister motives where, you know, all humans, crew expendable, whatever kind of language. Yep. And I think that's also kind of interesting, this sort of dystopian, you know, late stage capitalism kind of global, you know, or universal corporations, you know, that travel around and looking for the ultimate weapon, et cetera.
Can I weigh in real quick? My top three are Alien, Aliens, Alien 3.
Oh, really? Alien 3 bothered me.
I appreciate, well, maybe taking into account the incredibly small prep time, and like Fincher was just sort of thrown into it, like, hey guy, you want your shot? There it is. You got 2 weeks or whatever it is. Go for it. Even under those auspices, it has a tension. It has a vibe. I personally like it. I do like the connection to American Werewolf in London with the guy from the Slaughtered Lamb, but that's just me.
And I didn't like the CG aliens.
I didn't like the
CG aliens in Alien 3. It really bothered me at the time.
Were they CG? I thought a lot of them were actually still
no, the underwater
CG puppets.
You know, when there's this sequence, there are like three or four of them swimming underwater straight at, and she's trying to escape. I mean, Sigourney with a shaved head, yes. But it just felt to me like it was one of those things where they'd, you know, when a sequel just ups and ups every gag, like it's like,
yeah,
you've got a gag, it worked. And then we're going to make it like a bit bigger in the next one. And then we have to refer to it in the third one because we referred to it in the previous two. And it's like, really? It's just kind of,
I just didn't like Prometheus or Covenant really at all. Hmm. I think there's great parts of them. There's cool canon stuff where you get to see the space jockey and stuff that we'll talk about. You get to see some origin stuff, and even the Fassbender stuff, tribute, you know, sort of nod to Lawrence of Arabia and all that stuff.
I thought Fassbender was good. Yeah.
Yeah, there's great things about it, but as movies, they just don't do it for me.
No. I mean, there's a big drop down from the first two Aliens to Prometheus if I was sort of like rating them on some kind of graph.
Yeah. And I think have to say, in that drop down, Alien 3 catches a rope.
Prometheus there. Had that whole problem of the origins of humanity weird opening thing where they were seeding planets. But what I did like about Prometheus is the idea that you had somebody... Which was an idea in a script that was never made. It was the Alien versus Predator original script, which I have a copy of, where they were basically saying, hey, the predators have got these things that they want to hunt that are the most vicious things. They've made these genetic creatures called aliens so that they can see them on planets and then go down and hunt them because they're such good hunters. They need something better because walking around killing humans or anyone like humans isn't hard enough. So let's get this really great thing. It's a bit like a fox hunt where the fox can turn around and rip your face off. and I like that idea. And then the idea for me, maybe I personally read this into the film that wasn't there, is that that's what Prometheus was happening. So you had this kind of idea that you crashed ship that was carrying the aliens. Anyway, but I digress. I don't want to discuss that film. I want to discuss Alien.
Yep.
Matt, mm-hmm. Take us back. It's 1979, 25th of May. Tom Skerritt, John Hurt, Sigourney Weaver. We're in the year 2122. Yeah.
Yeah. The movie opens that day and it's a huge, relatively huge success. I think it does really well in that era. This is post Star Wars, post Close Encounters, I believe. And Alien is kind of the third film in that triumvirate of movies to come out that kind of redefine sort of the science fiction blockbuster kind of, I think.
Pre-Blade Runner,
yep. And
gosh, that's a thing, isn't it?
The overall budget for the movie was around $8.5 million, but reached about $11 million by the time it was all in, I think. And which I think is about $54-55 million in today's adjusted money.
Still not huge.
No, it's still really a relatively low budget movie. But one of the things that's really interesting is just for what it's worth, anybody who's interested in all this stuff, like there's the JW.
We all are interested in this stuff.
Well, yeah. No, but I mean, especially in this movie is the JW Rentzler, who's done all those great making of Star Wars trilogy books. And he did the making of Alien book. And I think he's even got a making of Aliens one that I haven't read, but and a Planet of the Apes one. And he passed away a few years ago, but he's a great writer and done so much amazing research. But there's that book, which is really, I think, the most epic tome. But then there's also the H.R. Giger Diaries, which is both in German and in English translated. And it's lots of his drawings and thoughts and musings during the pre-production, production design phase of designing.
Giger is like now creatures. Phenomenal. Like he's obviously seminal kind of creature source material, but was he that well known before? Like, do you know? Like,
he was pretty well known, I guess, in Switzerland as kind of this really like offshoot kind of character who was, pretty eccentric. Always wore black, which isn't that big a deal now. But I think in the 70s, this was kind of an unusual sort of character.
He was a goth before his time,
totally. And he was kind of more of a in the universe of fine art, he was a painter and started working with airbrushing. And I think that was kind of his real universe where he was working in. And he had actually been contacted by the whole story of Alien comes from the mind of Dan O'Bannon, who had made a movie called Dark Star and was kind of a science fiction geek. And he wound up with the title on Alien, anyway, a visual design consultant, but he wrote the original draft of the screenplay that I think was called Star Beast or something like that originally, or Memory, I think was the title. And eventually they came onto the title Alien. It was subsequently rewritten by, Walter Hill and David Giler, I think. And that was sort of what became the final script, the shooting script, and they added
the
character of Ash and stuff like that. But one of the things that was interesting about Dan O'Bannon was that he was working at one point. He was invited to where in France, I guess, and he went over and he was working with Jodorowsky on the Jodorowsky, the filmmaker of Tampopo,
Holy Mountain, and
Holy Mountain,
yeah, El Topo, Holy
El Topo,
Mountain,
yeah. And he was going to make a Dune movie, and he was going to have Mick Jagger was going to be in it, and all these characters, and you had Salvador Dalí was going to play the Emperor. And
Pink Floyd was going to do the score. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I mean, he had these crazy wild ideas, and he got all this money from these financiers, several million dollars. And Dan O'Bannon was invited over, and he had gotten through Salvador Dalí, who was going to play the Emperor. Dalí had introduced him to Giger, and he'd started to see some of Giger's work and started that sort of biomechanical and kind of hyper sort of sexualized design language. And so that went on for quite a while. And then this was before O'Bannon, I think, was working on the Alien story. And he was working
77, 76. There's a great documentary called Jodorowsky's Dune that has all this stuff in it that a friend of mine did the score for. But yeah, it's a great
documentary.
Anyone who likes Alien or any science fiction post 75 that's not Star Wars, I mean, Matt's leading to it, but Jodorowsky kind of assembled the all-star team.
Totally.
And when his version of Dune fell apart, everybody picked the bones out of that project.
Yeah, he brought in Ron Cobb, Mobius as one of a designer on the film, and Giger, and it just sounded like it was going to. And the artwork from it is so amazing, which they show in the documentary. And there's actually a book you can buy about Jodorowsky's failed Dune project, but just fascinating. But eventually that fell apart. O'Bannon came back to the United States, and he didn't have a whole lot of money and was looking for stuff to do. And he and a buddy of his wound up writing, the initial script for what would become Alien, and had been shopping it around and had some people who were interested. And I think that was the first thing that he'd written that he actually got optioned. And it was optioned, it was sort of came about at a really fortuitous time. And it got optioned in 76. And Star Wars was already in production at 20th Century Fox. Alan Ladd Jr. was the executive there that was approving different movies for production. They had searched for different people to direct. There were several directors attached to Alien. And then it kind of looked like it might go into turnaround and maybe it would never get made. They couldn't find a director. Some of the directors that were mentioned, which are kind of shocking, are Robert Altman at one point was approached, Peter Yates, Steven Spielberg was approached, which is just wild. I actually didn't know that until today, reading some more stuff about it. And then eventually Ridley Scott's name came up because Alan Ladd Jr. and some other people had seen The Duelists at Con, and they screened it, and which is weird because The Duelists, if you've ever seen that film, it's like a Napoleonic War era movie about these two guys in a duel, right? Sort of, I think it's a Joseph Conrad story. I can't remember, but
I think you're right.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And it's also a really great film, but it was Ridley Scott's first film. He was already a really well-known commercial director, had a really, unique compositional style. He had been at Royal Academy of Art and was a really good artist in his own right and could draw like a crazy mofo and had a great sense of lighting and design and stuff. And they eventually came to him sort of in the 11th hour, and he was really excited about doing it. I think he turned it down at first, and it went around to a few other people and finally came back to him, and a project he was going to do fell through. And so he said, okay, well, I'm going to come in and I'll do Alien. And in signing on to do the film, he was convinced that the most important thing was the alien, what was going to be the alien, what it had to, the big adult alien. It was the selling point of the whole movie. It wasn't going to work if that didn't exist. And Dan O'Bannon at one point got a copy of Giger's book that had come out, Necronomicon, I think is the title of it.
Necronomicon, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like a book of his most recent artwork that contained one image in particular that is a kind of an iconic image of a you know, the elongated head of the alien creature, and it's like a very kind of sexualized kind of image and stuff, but it was, and it's really dark and kind of perverse and creepy looking, and O'Bannon really liked it, and he showed it to Ridley Scott when the book came, and Ridley Scott immediately upon seeing it was like, this is it. That's it. That solves the problem. He knew that was the right look. It was something totally unique at the time, and really a fresh take on.
Even still,
yeah. And I think a lot of people have tried to ape that style over the years because it was such a huge land grab in terms of design. But eventually were able to get the studio convinced, and they got Giger on board as the designer, and assembled a team where they took over most of, if not all of, the stages at Shepperton Studios in the UK, where all these movies were being made at the time, including the first Superman movie, and then the second Star Wars movie was going to be shot there. And there was a huge, just like today, there were some great tax incentives that the United Kingdom was offering to films being shot there entirely with British crews. And so they set to work building, doing all the design work. They had a design from Mobius that became the spacesuits that are kind of the suits that they wear when they go out on the planet with all the armor and stuff, and built these massive environments and sets. And it wasn't really thought of as being a huge effects movie, but it was the idea of taking something that was kind of like Psycho, Rosemary's Baby, whereas you're sort of subverting expectations and creating this kind of horror genre type film. William Friedkin also was another guy who was approached to direct it at one point. The Exorcist was a touchstone, and they were thinking about combining sort of the concept and ideas of something like The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby with something kind of like Star Wars, right? That was sort of the fusion of ideas. Like, if we make something like this, that's a guaranteed hit.
You can see it, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like you say it, but I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, but they wound up building all these massive sets, and a great quote that I read that I just think is so awesome. They said that when they were looking at doing casting and they were finding all the actors, they wanted to build out the crew of the Nostromo, which is the name of the big ship that's towing the refinery that they land on the planet on. The little ship they leave in is the Narcissus, and they came with all these cool names that were kind of connected to these mythological characters. And when they're casting it, they had said that they looked at their crew and they said that their crew was the Rolling Stones to the Star Wars cast, which was the Beatles. And I thought, that's a good comparison.
That is
a really good comparison. Yeah. Or even the Roadies.
Yeah, totally. And there was this whole thing they injected into the script too. Walter Hill was on to direct at one point too, and then he backed out to make his movie The Driver that he went on to make. One thing that was really cool, production designer on the film, Michael Seymour.
No relation,
but a great name. Carlo Rambaldi was brought in, and he did some of the alien head effects, so the animatronics in the mouth and the squirting of the fluids and stuff, and the extending inner jaw. And then the special effects.
Can I just say that jaw coming out, that was unbelievably cool. And I've got to say, the thing that made it for me was the sort of Vaseline-y type goop that is the, I don't know what you call it, the spit or but the goopiness of the stuff that seemed to be somehow justified by just made it so, to use an overused term, organic. I mean, that for me turned it from being like a construct to a creature.
It's like petroleum jelly. It's a material called methacil. And it's like they use that in all kinds of like horror movies with goop and stuff of that nature.
But now they do.
But the other thing,
45
years ago, yeah.
This would have been the thing that invented the goopiness kind of, you know, because like the slime, I'm sure in Ghostbusters, you could draw a line from that back to.
Yeah,
to that. It just made it organic.
Horror movies prior to that too, like the Hammer films and stuff. But
And that's so much of the set design too. It was like it was a dirty universe, right? Yeah. It was this industrial kind of space.
Industrial is a good word. Yeah.
I think to Mike's point also, the thing about the you know, it's one of those, and this maybe is part of the horror link, like you see, like in a lot of horror movies, when the killer is finally attacking the person doesn't run. They're so transfixed by the horror of what's about to happen to them. They just sort of stand there and freeze or scream or whatever. And that is every action, more or less. I mean, there's some snatches and other things that happen in Alien, but when they show like Harry Dean Stanton get killed, spoiler alert, 45 years later, you know, it is exactly the tension is you see the thing kind of high over the shoulder, like it's so huge, but then we're looking at the face for like, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds of it's like shaking and like it's almost like it's revving up, right? And it's getting all pissed and snarling and the stuff's dripping, and then the mouth opens and the punch comes out. Like technically there's a lot of time to be like, I'm out of here, but nobody ever does because so, I mean, you've never seen that if you were actually existing in that moment. I mean, the horror of that moment of this giant thing that you know is going to kill you because it's killed other things on the ship and you're hunting it, whatever. It's the it's an efficiency that, and there's not a ton of cuts, and that's obviously stylistic of the time. You know, it was not an overly cutty time, but now you'd have like 19 cuts of the teeth and the this and the that and the someone looking and from the floor and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, Psycho had happened. We'd had a rapid cutting horror thing where you don't see what's going on and the rapid cutting made it. I mean, here, I think that's just the quality of the special effects because like when 77 is Alien, right? Jaws, 75, Jaws.
76, so, I think, yeah.
76. So whatever. But I mean, the point is, Jaws, it didn't work, right? It didn't look any good. It, you know, it just didn't look any good.
Yeah.
And so they couldn't use it. And so that was a whole different way of, you know, kind of dealing with that. In this, it looked so good. The team that did the visual effects was so great that you could hold on it for however long you just said. And yeah.
I think things that are really unique about the movie too, and still really show on screen when you watch it today. I went and saw it. Yeah, I've watched it, I don't know how many times on video, but I saw it again for the 45th anniversary and I saw it at the 40th anniversary in the theater and stuff. And it's like, it's always fun to go watch. And I feel like you see new things every time, but you know, the first 40, 45 minutes of the movie, nothing happens really. You know, it's really slow and you're really immersed in the environment. The movie opens with one, that great title sequence that's kind of like these hieroglyphics and it sort of shows it's kind of got a Saul Bass quality to it, you know, in a really reductive form, but shows the title Alien. And then it opens with that sequence with the camera sort of gliding through the hallways of the Nostromo, right? Of the big ship. And you see no people. There's evidence of people. There's kind of like, you know, papers rustling, and there's a door opens when they go into the room or the opening of the sleep pods or whatever they're called. And you see the little jackets kind of rustling in the air conditioning of the space. And there, I saw a great thing where Ridley Scott was, you know, he's thinking about everything. He's thinking about this ship all alone with this small crew in deep space. And he said he was thinking about the idea of ghost ships, right? Like the Mary Celeste and this idea of a ship that was, you know, legendarily supposedly found, you know, with the sails up and the food, you know, relatively warm, still on the plates, everything undisturbed and no one on board, you know, everybody had disappeared. Mm-hmm. I think that's somewhat of an exaggeration, but really cool, like cool ideas that set the stage and set a tone. And all the different environments, whether it's like the living quarters or the eating quarters or the hospital space, what do you call that on a ship where you get medical attention? No, where you get like medical attention.
No, it's sick bay.
Yeah, like the sick bay.
Well,
yeah, there you go.
Well, that's yeah.
That's a good term. I'll take that one.
In Star Trek, it's a sick bay.
But that's all like white and kind of clean and modern. And then all the other spaces are these really industrial workspaces that look like part of a big refinery or something. You know, it's clearly a big industrial work environment. And it's all built with old aircraft parts and like these huge machines. Yeah. And they kludge it all together in the art direction. And they make this universe with screens and things that seem logical and switches and things. And so the actors all have things that they can do. And it makes the world seem so much more real, even today.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to just touch on one thing to do with aliens, to do with visual effects not working before I forget, which I thought was a nice touch, which is Cameron's now doing Aliens. Yeah. So obviously we're in 86, which is quite a few years later, but nevertheless, they're trying to do the craft landing. Like there's this kind of, I'm going to call it a four-wheel drive, whatever, on LV-426. And you witness it on the video screens. And the reason for that is that the visual effects didn't work very well. Like the special effects of the models looked kind of crappy, but you stick them on a video screen with bad kind of what we thought of then as being, you know, sort of bad video, and you can't quite see what's going on. And suddenly it sells it. And you get that same thing that you got on Jaws, which is here, I've got a problem with things not looking quite right. Here's a creative solution. In Jaws, you don't see it. You just hear it with that great score that is forever etched in my DNA. But on Aliens, it was like, well, this isn't going to work. It's not going to look high quality. We're going to stick it up on video screens. And now you're watching it kind of remotely with people talking on headsets and stuff. And that idea of getting around practical limitations, because you couldn't just say, we'll fix it in post, is great.
But that is a perfect segue backwards. That is a nod to what Ridley Scott did when they first land on the... not LV 426. Where do they? I forget what the name of that planet
I think it
is.
Must be.
It's LV 426.
They don't ever give it a name in Alien.
Yeah, because the whole point is when Sigourney wakes up, yeah, she's like, oh my God, what's happened? And it's like, whatever it is, 50 years later, 57 years later.
Yeah.
And then they're saying, and we are now putting a team in 2179, converting LV 426 into a habitable planet. And she's, what are you talking about? Right. You can't do that.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, they're all these people, women, children have all landed and they're all like happy. And she's like, that can't be true.
Yeah. So in Alien, when they land on LV-426, Ridley had the same problem. They kept trying to shoot the approach of the building and the ship, the big kind of horseshoe crash ship. And he's like, it just didn't look right. Every time we'd look at it, it looked like a model. We couldn't get scale. And he said, so what we did was, he's like, I had an idea. I go, hold on, give me that. And he grabbed like a little Super 16 camera and he went and shot this like really close stuff with some smog and fog and smoke and moved the camera through it and then went back and piped it into the monitors when Ian Holmes looking at it. So that he's like, we piped it into the monitors, shot the monitors, and we're like, bang.
Yeah, and there's exactly like a breakup of the video signal and stuff. And so it's like you're watching what they're seeing. And then with the radio jargon back and forth, it just sells this idea of like all the elements on the planet where they're, you know,
and you only get a couple scene shots of them like lowering out of the Nostromo. It's just a bottom of the ship shot with a hydraulic lift.
Yeah. But you know what's really interesting? Like you've got this, because, I mean, you know, I'm not a fan of this, hey, back in the day when it was miniatures, it was all better. I don't buy into that at all. But what's happening back in the day is you do have limitations that you can't get around with a digital out. And my favorite that falls right in the middle between the, hey, we can't do this, so we've got to come up with some inventive way, and what I believe is immaculate creature work with, you can sit on that shot with that mouth opening for as long as you bloody like, it's going to look great to me. In the middle is Sigourney in Aliens with the lifter, because the lifter, she's in this rig. It doesn't obviously work, but it's shot for real. It's not a digital thing. Mm-hmm. And how do they do it? And the antennas that they stuck on top of it, which break the top of frame because they're antennas, are actually cables supporting the thing that she's in. And so the rig is basically hanging by the antennas, which just look like, I mean, of course, it makes no sense that you would need massive antennas the size of like, you know, 12 foot high bloody poles. But nevertheless, it works with the industrial design of those lifters. Those lifters, obviously, super plot point at the end. But at the beginning, when you first see them, she's walking around and lifting all these big boxes and showing that she's got cred. were so good, so believable. But that's in the middle, right? It's totally believable. And yet it was a physical problem. How on earth are we going to do these? And they go, well, hang on a second. What if we just suspended them out of frame? And but then you'd have two things going up. Yeah, but what if they were aerials? Oh, okay, that works.
Well, yes, so many of those kind of improvisations add to the sort of, forgive me, verisimilitude, right, of the way in which you experience the world. Like it really kind of gets you, it immerses you more in this universe in a way where it feels like the world we live in, right? Whether if even if it's a science fiction world, like things aren't perfect, things don't work. There are machines that are imperfect or that have these weird like engineering solutions that don't seem like clean and sensible, but they actually kind of work within the context of the story. Some just cool like original alien effects things that are kind of cool. The big landing gear when they land on the planet was built for real as an actual set on the studio, and it's kind of a lot of people might know this story, but the when they come down the elevator and they're walking by the landing gear, they built small versions of the spacesuits, and they had two of Ridley Scott's kids, I think, and one of the DP's kids in these costumes, and they're little, right? So they're a foot or two shorter than an adult would be, and it gives the and they shot it overcranked, and when they played it back, you know, at speed, then they were moving kind of more like adult humans, and they're still in those big bulky suits, but it made the set piece look much larger than it was, which again, you know, they're blasting all that vermiculite or whatever, the plastic that you dump into the fan or whatever to give the atmosphere of the planet. It winds up looking super cool when they're approaching the derelict ship, and you see this big shot that I think is partially model and maybe partially matte painting. The suits where they kind of have the steam coming out or the CO2 cartridges coming out of the back of the helmet, you see these little lights. And I think they said in one of the things I was watching, they're just little LED lights that they were moving, you know, in the shot. Like it's like this faraway shot where you think it's, oh, that's them. That's their helmets, you know?
Oh, yeah. But the medium shot of that is, again, the kids in the suits climbing the side of the ship.
Yep. The big holes that they climb into.
Let's not forget the repurposing of a Steadicam arm to put a machine gun on.
Yeah,
totally. That,
one of the
absolutely
Marines is the woman, two right? Marines. I forget her name.
Yeah, and she played John Connor's mom in Terminator 2.
Oh, that's right.
Stepmom.
Yeah. Stepmom. She gets the
foster
finger
mom.
Through the back of the
finger through the head. So, so was there an actual VFX, SFX company or team, or was it just a bunch of individuals?
So it was these two guys. It was Brian Johnson and Nick Alder were the visual effects or special effects supervisors is what they were called. And then they had a team of special effects technicians, one of whom was the late, great Guy Hudson, who I had the privilege of working with at ILM, who was a great puppeteer and model maker. But it was a small team of like eight or nine people at the peak. And they built a huge like 14 to 15 foot model of the refinery. And they had a model of the Nostromo that was originally painted yellow, I think. And when Ridley Scott came on as director, he immediately like didn't like certain things and came in and said, let's paint that gray. And then they had shot some stuff already that they were going to use, which Ridley Scott didn't like. So his way of kind of getting around it is that they theorized was to come in and make these changes so that he'd have to reshoot everything. And he wanted to actually be present for the shooting of all the effect stuff. They didn't use any motion control, which is kind of surprising at the time, given that that was a thing. They couldn't get a VistaVision camera because there weren't any available because they were all being used. And so they shot everything. You know, they made a dolly that they could kind of make go real slow, and they could kind of repeat some passes manually. They were able to shoot the scene where the Nostromo comes out on the docking thing. They actually covered in black duvetine and shot it and lit it in such a way. They had that on a forklift. It was a huge model, and the forklift just is driving out, and it's pulling with it the arm, the docking arm that lets go and releases the ship when they drop down to the planet. But a lot of the stuff when the ship is landing on the planet, they were blowing all kinds of atmosphere and stuff into the shot. Mm-hmm. And that's all shot like for real. You know, it's just shot live. They're not doing anything super special. And what's cool about it is it works, you know, in the scenes when they're finally on the planet, I think, and you see the windows and you see, I think you see it in the Narcissus when she's about to escape when Mother's going to blow up the ship. But then you see it also at one point on the planet, you see somebody in another window of the ship, I think. And that's all done with just projection. Like they shot stuff and then projected it.
You're missing the definitive, you know, defining moment of cinema that is Alien in this description.
Which is
the chest break.
Well, of course, yeah.
I mean, isn't that the thing that you go to first? I mean, that's in my mind.
Well, that's the scene that wound up selling Ridley Scott on the idea of making the movie for sure. Like, you know, there's a story in the Rensler book where the executives were reading this kind of B movie script and they read the part about the face hugger and that it sort of impregnates this character. And one of the executives was like, "Did you get to the part yet?" You know, and he's like, "Yeah, where the thing goes on his face." And he's like, "No, keep reading." And he calls him back 20 minutes later and he's like, "My God," you know, and it was the shot of the thing bursting out of the guy's chest. And that scene is so great. I mean, it's so classic too, where they, you know, the actors, of course, knew the scene, but they had no idea really what it was going to look like and how it was going to work. And so on the day, you know, they all wind up shooting the scene. And I think Veronica Cartwright, who plays Lambert, she gets like the bulk of a lot of like fake blood. And they have John Hurt, who, you know, rolls over on his back and has the thing come out of him. He does this great kind of twitchy acting. And the chest burster itself was a smaller, very small puppet model that they put on a rail. And it comes out and they animate it. And then it cuts to another shot where when it slides across the table and kind of has that almost mechanical sounding scream, it's just on a rail. And they had a guy underneath on a skateboard that they pushed and he's you know, sliding back on the rail with that thing.
That's amazing.
But one thing that's so cool about that
I was going to say, I remember you were about to tell the same story, but isn't it true that while the actors knew that they were setting up for a special effects shot, they didn't expect what was going to happen when it happened?
Yeah, like it was definitely a much more graphic, dramatic, and intensely gory and bloody scene. There were stories of people seeing the movie in previews in the theater. They would get up and leave the theater, and they were so mortified and disgusted. They had never seen anything quite like it at the time.
Was there also, I thought I'd read that leading up to it, up to the him like having it happen, that John Hurt like sold the performance so hard that some of the actors actually thought he was in like physical distress. Yeah, that there was some physical distress that he was, and so they're concerned, but because no one's stopping, they keep going. And then when the thing sprays, obviously, you know, I love just the shock on their face is real. Like anytime you can get that, like in Die Hard, when Hans Gruber drops, they told Rickman they were going to drop him on 3 and they dropped him on 2. You know what I mean? So the look on his face.
That is 100% true. Yeah.
Yeah.
100% there are muscles in your face that even a trained actor can't initiate consciously.
Yeah.
However, a method actor gets very close because a method actor recalls something and therefore initiates those muscle responses. But yeah, if you get a genuine also I don't know which Alien subsequent sequel it was, but it's one, maybe it's 3, where Sigourney's walking away, she's holding the basketball and she's meant to have really cool powers, and she throws the ball exactly over her head backwards, and the shot is her walking towards camera, behind her is the basket, and we see the ball go from her into the basket. And she did it in 1. I mean, she actually did it, right? The thing about it is they cut almost immediately when the ball goes through the basket, because all the hip actors that are meant to be playing hostiles on set all break into laughter and applaud the fact that she's done it, which, of course, in the movie doesn't work. So she does it, and then immediately it almost cuts to a cutaway of people going, "Pretty impressive." Well, instead of their goofy kind of, "Oh, my God, Sigourney, you did it."
One of the cool things, too, about... the actors following the chestburster scene, I don't know exactly when it was in the course of principal photography when that was scheduled, but I don't, you know, they obviously wouldn't shoot everything in order, but I think it was early enough in the shooting schedule that it changed the way the actors, this is one of the things they talked about in the Rensselaer book, it changed the way the actors thought about the movie they were making. It went from them, you know, playing their roles and being kind of these cocky characters who are sort of often at odds with each other because there's sort of this stratified class and the, who's doing what job, this kind of, you know, truckers in space vibe, right?
Yeah.
And following that scene and the sort of drama of that scene, and they all kind of felt like they knew, like, wow, okay, this is something pretty special. Like, this is a pretty cool project we're working on. And everybody in particular talked about, Parker and Veronica Cartwright and Yaphet Kotto both kind of doubling down on like the seriousness of their characters. And Yaphet Kotto plays Parker even at one point saying, like, you know, talking like between scenes, he's like, I'm going to kill this thing, you know, like, and really getting into the idea of the role that he's going to be, like, he's not going to let this thing kill him and all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of neat to think that of the actors also, you know, in these confined sets and these spaces working, you know, around, you know, pretty long hours to make this film and bonding, and that also changing the dynamic of the performances you get on screen.
But, but to your truckers in space, which I think is great, right? Like, long haul truckers in space. In Aliens, it's arrogant grunts, right? It's, and that is beautifully played by the actors in Aliens, because you can see Sigourney kind of being like, you guys don't know what you're up against. And they're like, we're kind of Marines, we're kick ass, we can handle it, we can. And she's like, you can't. And they're like, hey, little lady, kind of step back, let the real men kind of do it. And I think that was a beautiful thing that the second film didn't try to just make more ice truckers in space.
Right.
They changed that dynamic and it gave it, but it was a really good one to change it to, because it has in many respects the same emotional response, you know, in that you're sort of identifying with a very clear character type without being cliched or pantomimey. And yes, it was a different class, a different sort of genre, a different kind of group that you identified with. I thought, had they done the same group again, it would have just felt like a retread.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and you get, again, in that there are grunts in space, but like the only guy who really gets it is Michael Biehn's character, right? Like, he is the only one who gives Ripley respect, like right out of the gate. And of course, the most perfect casting ever of Paul Reiser. as the company stooge, like that, and he's along for the ride. And he's like the agency client on a commercial shoot. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you're like you kind of have to hang out with them, but you know maybe they're cool.
Dork, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they're just looking for lattes. And
but I've got to say, the other dimension that I in the same vein is the maternal aspects in Aliens, right?
Yeah.
Because you've taken what was this kind of workers industrial thing. And again, you have managed to come up with another metaphor, another emotional vehicle. It's not the same one, but it's got the same kind of vibe. And that whole protecting, because Ripley doesn't have a child in this sense, she has an adopted child. And those performances between her, when they, I'm thinking particularly when they're locked in the room and
the med bay room,
and the door is closed and you just like, oh my god. But
well, they added Cameron added a piece to the narrative and to the backstory that Ripley did have a daughter who in her time in hypersleep had aged to be an old woman and died.
So it's like
this whole thing of she had this daughter, but she never really got to be a mother to this daughter too. So there's that kind of lost, there's that instinct, but there's also that sense of loss too, which I think
that's
really
in, find that out in, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just think it reinforces the narrative where the addition to the alien life cycle with the addition of the concept of the alien queen, right? The thing that's laying eggs or whatever,
But that's the thing, right? So you, in order to have Ripley, like, for the audience's sake, I don't think Ripley herself needs it as a character, but for the audience's sake, they see Ripley taking care of Newt through the movie and being very maternal while being right. incredibly strong and probably the smartest character in the movie in a lot of ways, or at least common sense smarts. I don't, you know, they don't really mm-hmm. go into like, you know, mechanical knowledge, although she does, she's the one who says, pull up the vent structure and whatever. But
Carrie is that Hent, she the then, actress that played that young girl was genius.
No,
right?
It's like, phenomenal. Was, yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Go on.
But because you set up that, it's like a mirrored narrative, right? Because you set up Ripley, she's, in a sense, they're all killing alien kids for a set, for if you want to look at it that way, right? And then she meets the mother character. And of course, for obvious reasons, she has to destroy it. But there is that whole thing when they're tiptoeing through the thing and you see the queen and there's like, it's definitely a mother to mother kind of thing, which yeah, you wouldn't be able to get without
the flamethrower over the character. Top of the eggs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that was just such a, as I say, like the, just to hark back to where we started, like there's a reason why a sequel can be better or at least good in a different way than the original. And it's if it doesn't just walk the same path. Do you know what I mean? Like the Godfather Part Two is not just Godfather Part One done again. It's a whole different way of looking at a similar kind of subject matter. I think that's what you need to do. I think we suffer tremendously when sequels just think what they know, what the success of the first one was, and they think it's beats and individual kind of lines and not approach to the material.
One cool story. I think
that Carrie is now 50 something. But anyway.
Oh, I know. It's crazy. One cool story I remember reading, and I don't know, this is a long time ago. I read this, but I can only assume it's true, but that Cameron, when he was looking for something to direct, and he sort of had this idea where he's like, I think I have a sequel to Alien that would be really cool. And I think he pitched the concept, and to whomever the powers that be, I don't know if it was Ridley Scott or who had ownership of it, Fox or whatever. And they said, well, you know, can you get us a script? And the story I heard was that he went away for, I think, like 48 hours or 72 hours or something. And he went to like just a shitty roadside motel and he rented a room, and he had already had all these ideas in his head and maybe notes he'd taken, things he was thinking about. And he wrote the first draft of Aliens in, you know, a couple days, and had that script, like, at least in a shape where he could present it as like, okay, here's what I'm thinking. And I thought that was such a cool story, like the ambition and the inspiration to like riff on this original idea and be like, hey, I think I can, you know, make my own version of this that could be really cool and kind of turn it into something new.
The extension of that story, which I also think was initially lore and maybe had been proven true. I'm pretty sure it'd been proven true in that meeting where he presented that script and he's talking about the pitch and his thing. He said, but it really, they're like, what's the title? And he wrote Alien with an S and turned the S into a dollar sign.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You talked about Paul Reiser being so great as Burke, and I agree with you. Just really, a really beautiful casting. But I have to say, this is one of the films where I just so am upset that we don't have Bill Paxton with us anymore.
Yes.
Bill Paxton as Hudson, right, in Aliens. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's great in Titanic and all these other things, but in this film, he's just the schmuck you love.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, coming off Weird Science and a bunch of like fun, kind of kitschy movies at the time. Also, I mean, Aliens added a level of humor that is not in Alien, right? And that's the Cameron kind of like action. Like, he also, to be fair, Cameron is not burdened with setting up a world, right? He's exploring the world. So he's able to climb one more mountaintop after Ridley did such a heroic lift on Alien to like build this world and this story. He then gets to play in the playground and is able to add different tonal characters, and of course, to your point, Mike, making it grunts. Everyone knows that the grunts, like the space marines, are bravado and humor and seriousness and like insults at each other's expense. Like, it's a classic, it's a well-tread trope, but then he kind of takes it and expands it in the thing. Let's not forget also the like dispatch commander, the guy inside who gets hit on the head with the thing. Mm-hmm. He had just come off My Science Project, which was a very fun 80s kind of high schooly movie. And so, you know, they're just throwing all these guys in there who
you make a great point too, though, which I think is true of sort of the premise of what you set up, Mike, the idea of the sequel. Like this, when you make a sequel in a world that's been established in an original film, like you do have these other opportunities, as you were talking about that with Aliens. Like I just was thinking, like, yeah, you know, that you could say that about Empire. Like, why is Empire the one that, you know, diehard Star Wars fans will always say is the best one, you know? And it's because Irvin Kershner, you know, with that Lee Brackett script, like had the opportunity mm-hmm. to really, in a more deep way, explore all of the motivations of these characters and stuff and really embellish and enrich like our connection to everything that's going on in the world, the world building. Well, there's still more world building in that film, but, and in Aliens too, but it's just, it's building on like an existing knowledge base too. Yeah. That's a good point.
I'd also love to hear, Jason, your opinion as a director and DOP on the cinematography, because it's Adrian Biddle on Aliens, who is no longer with us, but he did like Thelma and Louise and a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. But this is all shot on film and they're dark. Do you want to just talk about, like, from a cinematography point of view, your opinions on it?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go to Alien for a second. You know, seeing it in the theater on the 45th anniversary with my kid who hadn't seen it mm-hmm. yet. And once I knew it was coming out, I was like, much like Close Encounters, you got to wait to see it in the theater, which, you know, these, and the first Blade Runner, like these iconic movies that he's been able to see in the theater for the first time. I mean, obviously it's a 45th anniversary print. It's been manipulated, not in terms of like probably some, you know, noise removal or, you know, some cleaning of some kind. But yeah, the cinematography is quite modern in Alien. Like it's definitely not, it's its own thing. He really set his own, he didn't ape, 2001. Certainly there's nods to it in production design, like in the mother room with all the switches and stuff. Like, I mean, that's, you know, definitely a Kubrick vibe, but yeah, I mean, it's clean. It's very clean. I think Alien is 16 or Super 16, right? It's not, is it 35?
No, it's 35. It's all anamorphic. 35. Except for
what's it called? Is 16 is the stuff he shot of.
Yeah. The stuff miniatures. He shot of the miniatures. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They then put on video screens. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's I got confused. Yeah, I mean, I think everything was anamorphic then, even stuff that was, you know.
Except the last shot when it's looking up at the engines of the Narcissus starting up, mm-hmm. that's spherical.
Yes.
The only shot it's in the movie that are spherical, but yeah.
That's a good deep dive on tech there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the term is really efficient. Like it's a really efficient approach to telling that story. There's not a ton of cuts. It's like you're in the back room of the, you know, truck stop hanging out with the people. It's not overly covered. It's not overly shot. It's very, very traditional in a sense, but moving into this more modern coverage.
The lighting in the sequence when the mother has activated the self-destruct is activated. Yeah. The way the lighting, and they do this in Aliens too, the way the lighting shifts from this mm-hmm. kind of real standard lighting, although they're using some like the arcs or whatever that would create the spark, yeah. the blue spark. They have a lot of that in the earlier parts of the sequence, and the CO2 that they're blasting mm-hmm. out in different parts is a big kind of thing that happens multiple times in the early parts of the film. But once the self-destruct sequences started, the sirens, the flashing lights, the stroboscopic lighting too, that mm-hmm. I think is also a really interesting at the time. Now it's pretty commonplace, but I think at the time that kind of visual chaos like was pretty fresh. It was pretty new. I think it was
certainly in a space movie.
Yeah, I think the director of photography is a guy, Derek Van Lint. I don't know that I've heard that mm-hmm. name before, but or since, I'm not sure, but yeah, I mean, it's definitely one that I think has a really a great aesthetic look, in part because I think those sets are just so amazing. There's so much backlighting. It's a really darkly lit film.
Super dark. Yeah. But also it's almost like, and I'm not saying Ridley did this, but based on the list of directors that had gone before him as possibly directing it, there's almost nods to all of them in a sense, because, you know, like all the chains kind of stuff when Harry Dean Stanton's going around, they're looking for the cat, and the cat has that. I mean, you can certainly see the early like tinges of what he'll do in Blade Runner, right? I mean, there's a ton of stylistic things he sets up for himself here unknowingly. I mean, he's telling the story, but he clearly follows them forward and takes to the earlier story, continues to take from Jodorowsky's Dune for Blade Runner, mostly Tyrell's building and some other stuff. But yeah, the low angles, kind of looking up, emphasizing everything, and the very dark lighting, but not underlit, not in this underlit way. Like, it's exposed properly, but it's the contrast ratios are higher.
I think part of it too is the way the sets are constructed, at least within the confines of the ship. They're the proscenium through which the actors are performing because of the set is compressed within the frame too. So you have all these really interesting framing devices that compress the actors and the action space, even in close up. There's not a lot of, like, you never see a lot of, except maybe in the outside in the spaceship or in the room with the space jockey or in the egg space.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of headspace. Another cool lighting thing is the, which Cameron reuses again in a couple different places in Aliens, but is the laser, the green laser light, which I guess they had said they got those lights from Led Zeppelin, like the people who are doing the lighting for the Led Zeppelin tour.
Rock concert vibe. Yeah.
But it's kind of cool. The idea of the thin layer of mist that if it's disturbed activates the eggs.
Yeah. Or whatever. Later used in many Judas Priest videos.
Yeah.
You said what's right?
But Judas Priest music videos. Oh. I think you got another thing coming. Our heads are going to roll one of those. I just
swear your head, like inside your head, is like an interesting place. I mean, I've known you years, and I just find inside your head an interesting place that you can pull that out. But okay.
But to Matt's point, like, it's such an amazing practical gag when you have the mist illuminating what is its own edge of laser that you're not doing anything. It's literally the mist is making it. And it's just dialogue. It seems to have this illuminated layer that's disrupted when I touch it. And like, the sound design too,
is so great.
Yeah. But they're also just playing with it, and they're going, oh, if we just say this, then it's true. You know, it's like in the Troll Hunters movie when they're looking at these big giant trolls in Norway, and they're trying to keep them out, and they're standing on the side of a road, and there's power lines, right? And it's like a total budget dialogue hack, and they're seeing these big power lines, and they're like, wow, there's so many power lines everywhere. And they're like, the guy goes, no, those aren't power lines, it's a troll fence, it's a giant troll fence. And you're like, oh shit, that's awesome, that's so smart. It's like, you just take what's there and then just make dialogue to explain it, and it works. But then, just to jump to Aliens, Cameron is the one who brings rear projection into the film, because there's no rear projection in Alien, but Cameron had done rear projection in Terminator when he had done all sort of the marching, you know, the Terminator sort of future battle scene in the beginning when all the stuff's happening. And then when the big ship is coming into land, when it explodes to pick them up because the alien's in the ship and kills the pilot, that's all rear projection. There's a bunch of rear projection stuff in there, and it's, I mean, it totally works. It looks, I mean, it's,
yeah, from a VFX point of view, yeah, no, true. From a VFX point of view, there are shots in this, both films, that don't stand up so well. Like, as I said, I like some of the miniature stuff, but there are other miniature stuff that looks to me like miniatures, right? Having said that, for something that's 45 years old, oh my God, like it's still really good.
I think another thing that does a, just real quick, one other thing just about Alien that I think is, it does a lot of work, is the Jerry Goldsmith score in Alien is so, it's so good. It's so weird. It's such a weird kind of mysterious and most of the time quiet score too, which is just so strange. And there's all these kind of musical cues that are kind of like gentle and distant, but that kind of clue you in on like, oh, it's not over yet. Oh, this is still going on, you know, which is kind of
And just straight sound design, right? Like my favorite scene where they're like, they should be not, and they're in the room and they're looking at the little panel with the dots beeping and the beeping getting more intense. And it's like, I can't stand this beeping.
But again, it's a very, it's an easy sell.
Easy
if you just say, hey, the more beeps there are, the closer they are. Instant, you know, it's like everybody the barrels and jaws, you know, like.
But the Ash and the Bishop android guts and the special effects
having,
that do those.
Having the white fluid for the the androids was also genius, right? Like something about white fluid just was such a good choice. I don't know if I'm saying that retrospectively because having seen it, I thought it informed me so well.
No, it's great. But also in the in Alien, you don't know he's an android until that moment, and then everyone's shocked. Oh my God! And then in Aliens, you know he's the android because it's now precedent. Everyone knows there's an android on board, and you know Lance Henriksen is the guy, and then of course he's incredibly helpful, and then saves Newt at the end, right? So they kind of redeem him, the android.
Yeah, they put a real corporate stooge in Aliens.
Yeah, exactly.
But by the way, another thing I wanted to say. Sorry, I was going to say the knife scene is another. Just we have to mention that the tapping between the fingers with the knife was.
The other thing I wanted to say about sequel versus original is, and I mentioned it briefly earlier, is that Cameron has access to a lot more money. And a lot more, I mean, it's expected that his movie will be bigger. So his sets and production design, I mean, he has massive sets, so many more actual rooms because they're going to a facility. You know, he has so many more rooms and things to play with to do set pieces. They have the ceiling bit, you know, where they come through the ceiling. And then, of course, the medbay thing where there's great lighting, where it's just red light, which they're kind of playing on in Romulus, at least in the trailers, you know, and I think an iconic section is Bishop going through the tube because of course a human could never do it, and he's like, no, I'm good, just seal me up as soon as I get in there. And then just that shot of him going like kind of like worming his way through is just, you know, I don't know, it's just there's so many, I feel like it's very hard to take a movie like Alien, and I'm not saying one up it, but be on par with it in terms of other iconic moments and things that makes your movie in our discussion maybe a better sequel than
so
other
here's
sequels.
The thing we have to finish because at some point we could go on for hours and happily so but let me just say this in the context of these two films, do you feel that you view them as competing with each other, or do you view them as being like one building on the other, or do you view them as just being part of a same narrative? I know they're different directors, I know there's different times, but
I just
of like emotionally.
They complement each other in different ways. I mean, you know, they really work as, I mean, before you even said that, I was thinking, yeah, they're like, they're great bookends, you know, to each other. And they tell, if you want them to, they tell one long story that's really fun to watch, you know, like, or you can watch either one, you know, individually, and I think still get the same enjoyment. But I think they're not in competition with each other.
Do you think that's a hallmark of a good sequel, that they are more like part one and part two? Obviously you can watch them separately, than competing with each other or just trying to play off each other. I think maybe that's a hallmark.
Well, it depends, because you have sequels that are in the world of that aren't direct sequels. And the one I'll point out is 10 Cloverfield Lane. Now, the Cloververse is a thing as opposed to a linear storyline. But you had Cloverfield. 10 Cloverfield Lane takes place in the Cloverfield universe. It is its own film. They mention what happened in New York or whatever, but really it's its own film. But it's a sequel, right? So there, that is, I think, a different type of sequel than what we're talking about here, or Star Wars or Godfather, because those are direct linear second films.
My son asked me the other day, my son asked me the question. He said, so does Alien and Blade Runner, do they take place in the same universe? And I thought, that's a great question. I'm sure that's been asked before. I said, I don't think so.
They're in the Ridleyverse.
But
anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, we have to finish at some point, and we may finish now, but I think we agree that the artists and technicians that worked on both of these films are really did outstanding work.
Absolutely.
I don't know whether they were, okay, I should look this up. I don't know if they were acknowledged at Oscar time. I know Sigourney got an Oscar nom for one of her Ripley roles, right? But I don't know if the VFX team or special effects team did. But without a doubt, they've stood the test of time remarkably well, both technically and cinematically. I think they're just spectacular work. And again, it's always so hard looking back on these films, isn't it? Not to kind of judge them by today's eyes, but also to place yourself in a world where they hadn't existed. Like, as you said earlier, I hadn't even thought about that this coming out when there was no Blade Runner, right? Like these sort of ideas of human looking androids and stuff, like all this stuff now is cinematic language that we know and love, but there was a time when all of that wasn't obvious. It wasn't all like kind of played out. The industrial grungy wasn't the thing.
Alien likely wouldn't have existed were it not for 2001 and Star Wars. It's so it's kind of interesting too to think about the shared collective DNA of films that are pushing genre or pushing the medium in a way that's really different, that then lead to opportunities for other storytellers to come along. And like, now there's a proven track record where somebody, a studio is going to be willing to like, okay, well, we'll put some money in this. Like, oh, it's going to be, yeah, Star Wars meets The Exorcist. Okay, we'll do that. You know, like that sounds like money in the bank or whatever. So,
and also, you know, you had Kubrick did his thing with Trumbull, and then Trumbull became a thing, right? He like became the guy, and including working with Spielberg on Close Encounters. And then you have Lucas makes Star Wars, and he makes a thing, and he makes the actual first kind of big juggernaut, you know, visual effects, special effects kind of monster. And then Ridley makes his movie and does not do anything. He's just a director. He doesn't spin up some entity that follows him throughout his career. And I think, you know, I don't know, there's not a ton of people that do that. That did what, like, say Spielberg or Lucas. I mean, those are obviously very specific things. Later, you're
talking about running up in the DNA of ILM here. Is that what you mean? Like,
no, I'm just saying in general the approach of people doing groundbreaking things at that point in history. You had people who saw the sort of opportunity to become a thing, that they do a thing. Like Trumbull does a very specific thing. Broad thing of things, and he made a company about it, right? And Lucas made his movie and said, I'm going to make a company that's going to solve all my problems, and then that became a thing. And I'm just saying, in this pantheon, Ridley went on to be the same level sci-fi guy as those guys, and he did not do anything but stay as a director. And obviously, he has his own production companies and things like that, but he did not lean into, hey, these are my guys who do this, did this for me, and now this is my thing, you know, Ridley Light and Magic or whatever, you know. So I just find it's an interesting, I mean, it's not a thing, right? It wasn't a thing, but it is now, because you have Peter Jackson goes, hey, I'm going to make Lord of the Rings. Well, I'm going to, you know, work with Weta, and then that's going to become the thing, you know.
Yeah, and George Miller did D-Film, right? Off the back of Mad Max, Heavy Feet, and...
And Cameron did Lightstorm or whatever it was called.
Well, also you could argue
Digital Domain. And then later Digital Domain. But so, you know,
we absolutely at some point have to stop this podcast.
Yeah.
So, as fun as it is talking. Matt, where can people find you?
at mattwallen.com. Plus, next week, although maybe this will come out while we're there, but I'll be at SIGGRAPH in Denver.
I can't travel to SIGGRAPH. I've got a bad back. I will be at SIGGRAPH Asia, but John Montgomery will be at SIGGRAPH in Denver. So have a good time there.
We'll have a margarita for you.
Please. Jason?
I am sadly not going to Denver. I am everywhere. You can type in the name Jason Diamond. That's not a writer or a plastic surgeon or a dentist.
Okay. And obviously, I'm at FX Guide. Guys, thanks so much for going down this path. We have some great films coming up, not least of which is Wolverine and Deadpool. I don't know if you guys have seen it yet. I saw it on an early screening. Lots of thoughts on that film. Won't save any spoilers right now. And we won't do that straight away because of spoilers, because it's even, there's an entire campaign from Deadpool's PR team to avoid spoilers because there are so many spoilers. And you can't discuss that film without shattering a whole lot of people's enjoyment if they haven't seen it yet. So we'll give it a week or two and then we'll discuss it, but definitely on the agenda. Anyway, thanks so much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See ya.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.